Hi, welcome to Cloud Cover. My name's Nathan Totten.
And I'm Nick Harris.
And we're joined today by Jay Haridis, who's a Windows Azure, who's a developer manager on Windows Azure Storage, right?
Yeah.
There's probably a few more words in there since it's a Microsoft title. It's some, you know, there's lots of pre and post titles in there, yeah. So great.
Definitely excited to have you on the show.
I'm excited to be here.
Cool. So before you show us some really cool demos you have lined up and other information about storage, let's go into the news as we always do.
Yeah, I notice you're wearing a tie today.
That's right. So for those that haven't watched the episodes, and also Jay has no idea why I'm wearing a tie. He didn't say anything. He just thought I'm insane.
I just thought.
But so a few episodes ago, you were wearing a tie or a T-shirt with a tie painted on
it. That's correct.
And you were making fun of me for not dressing better on the show.
Well, all good news presenters wear ties, man.
So I wore a tie today to really class up the show. So next time you'll be wearing a tuxedo, right?
Maybe. It's not exactly a power
top
tie,
hat.
Though.
No, it is apparently red. Is that a power tie?
Apparently. I don't know.
So our first thing has to do with data center expansion and capacity planning. So we've had a few additions to data centers. We announced, I guess, about a month or so ago, the West U.S. and East U.S. regions. So when those will launch, they only had compute and storage, I believe. I think just those two services. So last week we announced that SQL Azure is now available in both of those regions. And then, as we talked about before, this also means that some other services that have dependencies on SQL Azure should be coming online shortly. I don't have a time frame for that too, but I know what was it like ACS and Service Bus, I think, have dependencies on SQL Azure, so those I would imagine will be coming online shortly. So,
nice.
One interesting thing I thought was actually quite cool is Windows Azure today. Our customers running on Windows Azure use more computing power than existed in 1999.
Wow!
Which I thought, it's 12 years, whatever, 13 years is a lifetime in computing. But even that, I mean, that's a ton, it just seems like. So that's pretty cool. I mean, sounds like we get to keep our jobs since people are actually using Windows Azure, so that's good.
Awesome.
That's good.
Keep up the good work. Yeah.
So in our next little bit of news, I'll let Nick go ahead and talk about that.
Right. Yeah, so on the Windows Azure blog, we've actually got a blog post here by John Shuchuk. He's a technical fellow here at Microsoft. And he's talking about reimagining Active Directory for the social enterprise. So it's part of a two-part series. So far, only part one has been discussed or posted, and essentially they're talking about Windows Azure Active Directory. So if you look here on the screen, Windows Azure Active Directory, essentially what they've done here is they've taken Active Directory and they've made it operate in the cloud as a multi-tenant service with internet scale, high availability, and integrated disaster recovery. So people should note, as he sort of talks further, as he goes down through the article here, that Windows Azure Active Directory is not, you know, Active Directory as it is today. They've done some significant re-engineering and re-architecture of the solution. So that's all discussed within the post, so I'd encourage you to read it. But if you want an example of some things that are currently using Windows Azure Active Directory, we have Office 365 as an example. So quite a detailed post, and it's definitely worth reading and perhaps jumping on and following for the next post, because the next post is going to talk about more from a developer perspective how developers would utilize this.
Cool. And so to clarify, this actually isn't available yet.
No.
He's talking about something that they're building that's coming eventually. Cool.
Yep.
Cool.
But it's already in use by Office 365, yep. Just not generally available for everyone else.
Cool.
So the next thing that we've got here is Meet Windows Azure. Did you want to talk a little about this?
We talked about Meet Windows Azure last week. It was announced about 3 weeks ago. So this is an event we're doing in San Francisco. It's a limited invite in person, I think, sort of an invite-only top secret event, maybe. Not top secret, but in person, limited audience. But then we're going to be streaming the sessions online. So Scott Guthrie and some other presenters will be talking about the latest features and such with Windows Azure in San Francisco, and that's on the 7th, so you can go to meetwindowsazure.com, and we'll put a link, as always, where you can actually register to watch online.
Right.
And then our next bit of news, again, we talked about last week, this is the Learn Windows Azure Day at TechEd. So for anyone who's already registered for TechEd, you'll actually be able to attend this in person. And I think there are still tickets available for TechEd, or I don't know if it might be sold out.
I'm not sure.
I don't know. if there are, you can still go. If not, but even if you can't go to TechEd, you know, whether you can't travel there or you live in a different country and it's not worth the plane ticket or just didn't buy a ticket, we'll also be streaming that event online. Okay. So we have some really great speakers lined up, Scott Guthrie, Mark Rusinovich, Quentin Clark, and and Bill Staples. Yeah, Bill Staples will be presenting also. So, yeah, some really, really great speakers, and that, again, totally free streaming online. So you can go to the website here. We'll have a link to. And this one you don't have to register for, but we have links where you can actually add that to your calendar.
And so for the last piece of news that we've got here, we've actually got a new technical evangelist on our team. His name is Chris Reisner, and he's just recently joined us. But his area of speciality is developing for iOS and Android, and integrating those two client platforms with Windows Azure. So he's picked up the work on the Windows Azure Toolkit for iOS and the Windows Azure Toolkit for Android. And just recently, he's rolled in some changes and reviewed some changes by Scott Densmore, who's someone else here at Microsoft that's made some changes on those two repos up on GitHub. But essentially now we've got some better samples in there. So we've got a sample there that demonstrates how to connect with Facebook. We've also got a Tweet Your Blob sample there as well for iOS. So it's definitely a toolkit worth looking at if you're interested in developing for those devices.
Cool.
Yep.
So, all right. So with that, let's move over to talk about Windows Azure Storage with Jay.
Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
And now, our feature presentation.
So to begin, why don't you tell us just a little bit about what you work on and then what you're going to be showing us today.
Sure. I'm a dev manager in the storage team, and what we have provided is an autoscale storage service and built from ground up so that it can handle whatever traffic is thrown at it. It kind of load balances based on the traffic needs, and we've provided a couple of abstractions out there, which is tables, blobs, and queues. So I'm in the engineering team managing the development of the front-end services and the client libraries and the health monitoring system for the Azure storage system itself.
Hmm. Cool. Okay. Yeah. Awesome.
Impressive.
So so today you've got a few demos and then just some general... Right. I mean, a lot of our users have asked about, you know, we sort of have these scale targets that we say we're with Windows Azure Storage, and some people, you know, they don't know, okay, like, what's a partition? How do I scale as a partition?
Yes.
You know, how do I make my blobs? How do I query them? All kinds of, you know, there's a lot of complicated things with storage that I think, you know, you need to know kind of the right way to do something in order to build an effective, scalable solution on Windows Azure. So hopefully today you can teach us a little bit about that.
Right. So I'll be concentrating on basically Azure Table today.
Okay.
But the same concepts apply to queues and blobs. Sorry, I forgot out there. So queues and blobs have the same concept about how to kind of use the partition key to scale.
Yep.
Right. And so I will cover it with respect to the Azure Table stuff, and then how do you design? Because I think Azure Table is a NoSQL structured storage system, and that requires a different paradigm to design for a NoSQL store. And so what I would do is try to get through all, how do you design in a NoSQL storage system? What are the best practices? What are the things to look out for? And then we'll go through a sample to exactly show what I mean by saying things have not changed much, except that the paradigm shift is from Sprox and everything in the table schema, a normalized form, to into your application layer. And so I would go through certain examples out there and give out the best practices surrounding how to design for scale, basically.
Cool.
All right.
And now for something completely different.
So yeah, I just wanted to go through all the characteristics of Azure Table that one would need to know before starting to use it. We have the concept called entities. And entities have three mandatory properties, which is partition key, row key, and then timestamp. The partition key and row key form your clustered index, which is basically defines your sort order. And your timestamp forms the etag. It's meant for etag. It's a read-only property, mm-hmm. and it forms your etag for optimistic concurrency. And I'll go over where you would use etags and things like that.
Okay.
So besides those three mandatory properties, it's schema-less. So we said it's a NoSQL store, and it's a schema-less store. So there's no schema. When you create a table, you don't have to kind of give a schema associated with it. And because it's schema-less, you can do a lot of these different things of storing different kinds of entities in the same table. And again, we have a sample that goes over the benefits of that. So the first property, it's a schema-less, which you can make use of. The second one is your partition key, which I'm just calling it as PK, and row key form your clustered index, and hence your sort order. Your partition key is, you can think of it as your shard key. That's what you would use to make sure that, to have entity locality, which means all entities with the same, in the same table with the same partition key would be served by the same server. It's not with respect to the location of the data, but it's served by the same server to have transactional consistency and things like that. And so your partition key, row key are the index, and timestamp is the E tag. There's no limit on how many entities you can have in a single table,
okay,
right? And so you can have as many entities as possible. When it gets to, okay, how do I design my schema? Some of the normal questions that you could ask is, okay, what is my size of the partition? How many transactions does a partition support? Or how many transactions can I do per account? And most of those numbers are already there on a blog, but a partition can support up to 500 entities per second. And an account can support up to 5,000 transactions per second.
Is it 500 entities a second or transactions against that table, like if I'm reading or inserting?
Right. With respect to queries, it's a different beast. And I will get through, okay, what kind of queries are efficient and how do you... It's not necessary that if you retrieve 20 entities, it's not necessary 20 transactions per second as such. Right. So when I meant entities, it was more for updates and all the CUD operations rather than the retrieve operations.
Okay.
But however, there are certain things that you need to know when you're designing your schema, when you're querying, because there are certain limitations, like we return continuation tokens at partition boundaries. We return, we allow 5-second interval for your query to execute. So these are some of the things that you need to keep in mind when you're developing, especially a website, because it is latency sensitive. You don't want to wait for 5 seconds before you start displaying certain data. So how do you design around that? So like I said, a lot of this is basically a paradigm shift where your application layer has a lot of this knowledge. So how do you design a schema as such? What are the things that you would consider while designing? It's not very different from the traditional way. You need your scenarios first. You need to understand what scenarios you're developing for. Once you understand what scenarios you're developing for, you can list out all your objects and the attributes that belong to that object. So in how to design, the first thing you would do is objects and attributes. And this normally comes from your schema as such, or rather your scenarios. Once you know your scenarios, for example, if I want to use a registration, or if I want a document sharing social network service as such, saying that, okay, this is my user registration process and I want it as fast as possible. This is my document upload, which will be an asynchronous process because there's a workflow associated with it. Mm-hmm. So you list out all your scenarios as such, and by scenarios, it also lists out, I also mean queries as such. What are your top queries that you're going to execute very often, especially... This is more important when you get to scale scenarios, where you really want internet scale. You need to start thinking about, okay, what are the queries, my topmost queries that I really wanted to be performant? Yeah. And this is no different from what you do in SQL Server when you're in a relational database system. Because again, you think about queries, what are your indexes and things like that. And that's your schema design in a traditional relational database system. Out here, it's very similar, except that the logic, again, lies in your application layer.
Right, so that's pretty standard sort of design design processes.
Yeah.
Identify your objects, attributes, and what scenarios you're catering for.
Queries-wise,
you're looking at the read capability. So the scenario you've proposed has some write, has some background process for uploading that document, but There's also other applications which are very write-intensive rather than read-intensive.
Yes.
So is the process any different if I were developing like a write-intensive application? Are there different considerations?
It's not, because I think the third point where we get to is, or rather I'll get to it in the fourth point, which is how does it scale?
Yes.
Or rather, does my schema right now, once I have a normalized form, does it scale once I selected my partition key or my shard key and things like that?
Right.
Does it scale enough? So the next one is uniqueness. Uniqueness, because every entity needs to be unique. So how do you design your partition key and row key? What forms a unique ID as such? For example, if I'm uploading a blob, a file, a video, or something of that sort, if it has an ID associated with it, and let's call it a document ID, then that may make it unique, so that the same user can have multiple documents uploaded, right? Uh-huh. And then comments associated with it, each one needs an ID again to kind of differentiate it. The author of the comment is not sufficient because he can have multiple comments and things like that, right? So you would have uniqueness associated with it. So once you have all this, you might come out with a kind of a normalized system, which is good if you're not looking for scale. If the number of requests per second for the partition key that you've selected using this criteria is sufficient enough, then that's good. You can just stop and use that particular design for your model.
The default is like, right, I've got a person and an ID. And so you're saying that if I don't expect to get like more than 500 transactions per second, or you know, if I'm just operating like kind of, I mean, that's a pretty high load website or web application, or application of any kind, like that's where I can stop and say just, okay, that's really easy, ID, you know, all the other fields, email, first name, username, whatever, are all in the fields, and then I'm good to go.
Right. You always design for the worst case scenario in terms of your projection of how many transactions am I going to get and things like that. So once it meets that high bound of how many transactions you're going to expect, I think you can stop there if you feel that it's within the limits that we've published, right?
Yeah.
If it is not within the limits, that's where you go and say, okay, what can I do? For example, if it's logging, I'm logging a lot of data, right? A usual thing to do, it's very normal to go and say, okay, I'm going to use this date time stamp as the key, right? And so it's a different partition, it looks good and things like that, but there is something called an append-only pattern or prepend-only pattern that people need to avoid, and I'll go over the range-based partitioning system that we use. That's the kind of main reason why you need to avoid the append and prepend patterns.
Okay.
And so the next question you're going to ask is,
The next question I was going to ask is, what are those published limits?
Right. For a partition, it's 500 entities per second that we publish. And again, the reason why we publish these limits, it's not, the reason is because we want to give a consistent feel for you.
Right.
You might be able to get more than 500, but we want to make sure that if your system now starts issuing, let's say, 40,000 transactions per second per partition, and our system, when it's under load, may start throttling you more than a user who's just sending 20 requests per second. So there is this isolation factor built into the system.
Right.
And so we want to make sure that, and there's this fairness too, so we want to make sure that we give a consistent look, or rather consistent feel for our users, and hence we publish the limits as such.
So they're almost, it sounds like the limits we publish are actually not limits as much as they're guarantees, right?
Yeah.
I mean, are we saying that we're guaranteeing you'll get 500 requests per second on a partition, or are we not saying that either?
No, we're not saying it's a guarantee, because it's a multi-tenant system, and so we do not guarantee that. We say it's up to 500 requests per second.
Okay.
But yeah, there are various reasons why you may get throttled earlier, and load balancing, and when I go through the range-based partitioning system, that's one of the things where we'll get to how the system actually load balances to kind of meet the traffic needs.
Okay,
right.
But they are you know, pretty reasonable, for the most part. If I'm a developer, I can pretty much assume that, you know, 500 is a reasonable number to target before I have to start, you know, considering alternate designs and all these sort of things.
Right.
Gotcha.
And it's not just that 500, it's all these things that get it, or rather, because if, for example, if you need a transaction atomic transactions for your document and comments, right? Mm-hmm. And you want to increment the number of comment count on your document whenever you insert a comment. You want to do that in an atomic transaction rather than an asynchronous fashion or something of that sort. So, which means now, if they are in the same table, you need the same partition key on both of those.
I see.
And so that also drives how your schema is built. So it's objects, scenarios, queries, and stuff like that, uniqueness. Does the limit satisfy? And also, what are your atomic transactions that you need? Because all our batch transactions require the partition key to be the same for a given batch transaction, which is, if you want it to be atomic, it has to have the same partition key for all your entities in that particular request.
Gotcha.
And that drives your schema design too. So these factors that drive your schema design. In addition, what I wanted to kind of go through is, we are a range-based partitioning system, and what does that mean as such? So imagine that your partition key has this bound, right? It can be from 000 to 999 for your particular scenario.
Okay.
Just imagine that,
right?
And so you start inserting these entities randomly across this range. What happens is our system recognizes that, okay, there's a load on this table, and it's best that I load balance it. It's going to, and all this is being served by, let's say, a partition server P1.
Right.
It's going to go and split this into, let's say, 200, 201, 2999, and this is served by now P2, and this is continued to be served by P1, for example, because there's more load out here, and even though it was random enough and things like that.
And storage is doing this for us.
And storage does that. You don't have to do anything about it, except that you need to decide what your partition key is.
Right.
Based on that partition key, every entity with the same partition key will be served by the same partitioning server.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so this keeps going on with the load balancing stuff based on your traffic needs. And this is what kind of allows you to scale, basically, right? Because of many servers, it can split many times, and now you have far too many partitions, and each range can do a lot of requests per second. It's better than just one server serving the entire range.
Yeah. Right. So the more traffic you put on it, the more partitions. I mean, it may not happen in practice, but in theory, you could have one partition per one partition server, right?
Yes.
And so in this scenario, you could potentially have 1,000 or...
So you can imagine that every
minus one, I don't know.
In theory, every entity can be served by a given partition server, for example, right? In theory, but it's a multi-tenant system. There are many users out here, and it load balances based on all the traffic that it sees. So our system does that for you. As I said, this is the reason why it scales. Now, one of the patterns that you need to avoid is, imagine that you're always going sequential. So in a given 5-minute period, you always hit 000. After 5 minutes, you hit 001, 002, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Yep.
That's going to keep it all on the one
server,
right?
It always goes to the last, if it's a lexical sorting, if it is ascending order, it always goes to this last partition server.
All right.
Which means your throughput now has reduced, even though you have... Initially, I said more number of partitions, the better. Even though you have more number of partition keys, your traffic is still served by one partition server, and which is always the last range. We can do. We can split this how many ever times. The rest of it is going to be cold, and just this last range is going to be hot.
The table storage system is going to figure out, okay, 000 is getting hit a lot, so let's move that off the rest of them that aren't getting used. But then you're going to switch, and you'll use the one that has everything.
Yeah.
It'll keep doing that, but
it's
never going to get ahead of you. So it's
okay. Right. So and the same thing happens if it's prepending.
Sorry, go on.
Sorry.
No, go on.
And the same happens even with prepending. Like, this is the append pattern.
Yeah.
And if that's ascending order, if you go in the descending, the same stuff happens. It's the first partition, which is always going to be first partition in your range that is always going to be hot.
So the recommendation then is to somewhat randomize the order that they're going in?
So there are various ways to do this. One of the things is, let's assume that I'm expecting I'm expecting like 500 requests per second, or 10, let's say 1,000 requests per second, right? Mm-hmm. One of the ways to do it is put a random hash ID in terms, buckets, divide it into buckets. So if you have 1,000 requests per second, and it may grow in future, so I would say, okay, let me create 15 buckets or 20 buckets, and then I'm going to distribute this across 20 buckets, right? So I'm going to prefix it with a random hash ID. Right. So it's going to be 0, and the next entity might be 20, 0, 0, 20, and things of that.
Gotcha.
And so now what this gives you is your scenario where you're saying that, hey, I have far too many writes per second. I'm not worried about reads. This works very well because it's random. It goes across different partitions, and it's well distributed, basically. You can prepend it with a hash, and that gives you the randomization, and it scales up. For queries, what you would do is you would use parallel queries and then start issuing these parallel queries across these different buckets and retrieve it. So that's how you would query when you start using this hash ID as such.
Okay.
So you're saying I break my zero partition up into buckets using a hash, so there's multiple for zero? You're saying more so across each?
Across
of the
each. So let's assume you want to divide everything into 20 buckets.
Yep.
Right? So every entity that you get, irrespective of whether it's 0 or 1, you're going to prefix it with a hash of 20.
Random.
And it's random.
Yep.
It's random. Gotcha. And so now it's distributed across different partitions as such.
Yep.
And so that's one way to do it. This is the range-based system that has kind of led to this append and prepend pattern, right? The reason we gave a range-based partitioning system is when you want a list, we want it to be a range so that you have locality. So all the zeros and ones can be listed together rather than we providing hash.
Mm-hmm.
And for a write-intensive scenario, our users can actually hash this and get the write throughput, even though we are a range-based partitioning system. So they kind of simulate the hash-based system on top of a range-based. And so that's the kind of a benefit of going through this rather than the system providing you a hash-based partitioning system. The other thing which we went through the range-based system. The other thing which I wanted to clarify, especially with the sort order, we only give you one clustered index and one sort order, right? Because it's just one. We give you just one clustered index. So all your entities are sorted using partition key and row key. This also means that, let's assume, forget row key for example. Let's assume that you have partition key of 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on. This means that, actually, 9 is greater than 10 because it's lexically sorted.
Mm, yep. Right?
And so if you want to maintain your sort order somehow, you need to make sure it's fixed length.
Yep.
And then you prepend 0, 9 now. And now 0, 9 is actually less than 10. In your lexical sorting.
Yep.
So this is another thing which usually you will use this trick to kind of, especially with your date timestamps and things like that, you would use this trick to kind of make sure that everything is consistent.
I think in the past I've done for date times where you basically just do date time max minus date time. You're laughing like that seems like a bad, it's probably, is that not good?
Or? No, that is the way to get, for example, even in the sample which I've taken, I've listed all, so I want to list all the comments, right? How do I get the latest comments? Because it's sorted, all my latest comments go to the end by default.
Yep.
Unless I do this max minus current time and use that as a ticks and fix length.
So depending on the date, like log data, you would maybe want to do that also because often, I mean, usually the most recent log is the most relevant. You wouldn't want to start, okay, this is from 6 years ago. Yeah. Let me go through all of them.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Did I ruin you? You were gonna talk about that later, and I ruined it.
No, I think it was a good, good. I mean, the sorting stuff was good to kind of get that covered. Just want to point out with log data, especially, it can be in whatever sorting order, but if you want the log, you usually know what time range. And so you can convert that into ticks and just do the greater than equal to partition and less than. So you don't have to do the minus to get the topmost. It's usually with comments where you don't
that
know how far behind was a comment inserted and things like that.
I see.
So
So yeah, I mean that meant just to clarify, logs, like you aren't actually, even if you're doing it in full order, you're not really going to say, okay, give me the logs, start at the beginning and go next through the continuation tokens.
Right.
Just say, give me the logs from today or something, which actually I think is I've seen that in, like, I know Sarah Brada has Cloud Storage Studio, and that's common. It says, you know, do you want the logs from today, from yesterday, or from all time? And if you do all time, you get, you know, a ton of them. But okay, very cool.
Going back to the query stuff while designing, what's most efficient? So the lookup, single entity lookup, where you use the partition key and row key, is the most efficient. The second one are small range scans. So you might have, give me the top 10 comments, for example. Those are also more efficient. And when I talk in terms of efficiency, it's like, it's basically for my website as such, right? I want to make sure that I get all these entities and project it on my web and feed it back to the user as fast as possible. So for such things, it's usually small ranges are fine.
A range of partition keys?
A range of partition keys or a range of row keys.
Or row keys, okay.
And the reason I don't want to kind of go and commit to saying it's a range of partition keys or row keys is everything depends on selectivity. And I have a good example where your selectivity, it's the number of rows that needs to be iterated on the server that matters more than how many rows are returned.
I see. I see.
And so that is what drives what is efficient for your scenario. And so always aim for single entity lookups, like user registration. You have the user ID. Usually he logs in using user ID. Mm-hmm. Use that as your partition key, for example.
Or an email,
a
hashed,
whatever
some sort of
ID
hashed
is.
Email or something.
Yes, whatever the ID is.
Usually the real, I've gotten in that situation where an email address, there are characters allowed in email addresses that aren't allowed in the partition key.
Yes.
So I've had to like hash the email or something.
So there are certain emails,
Or base64 encoded.
Base64 is good. One of the things with string hashing is when you change to some other .NET, I don't think .NET guarantees you the hash.
So things like that that have non-allowed characters, base64 is, okay.
And it's also a good practice in terms of if you have these characters, it's always good to kind of ensure that they are not these safe, unsafe characters in URI. It just makes your life much easier as such. Anything that needs to be escaped and things like that is a pain. So it's always nice to kind of have your own hashing, like base64, whatever you use, use that for your partition key and row key to make sure there are no unsafe characters. We have listed all the characters that are not allowed in our documentation, but even otherwise, there are more unsafe characters in the URI that we allow.
I got you.
So I think the next thing to do to go over is a sample. The sample that I've chosen out here for the demo is basically it shows a website, a document sharing website, and there's no website as such. I'm not a UI person, so I just have a data model designed as, for this sample. And what are the things that you can do to kind of design a system that scales?
Okay. Right?
And the benefits, the selectivity which I mentioned. How important is that selectivity factor as such to understand the various ways to design your schema? What are the trade-offs? And so we will go through a sample out there. The first thing I want to go through is user registration. For this, I don't have any code. But I just wanted to use this particular sample to define a common question that gets asked is, how big can my partition be? Mm-hmm. Or how small can my partition be? There are users who try to go and collate entities into a single partition just because they feel that, okay, having too many partitions is not good enough. I think as many partitions you can have is good because our system will load balance it. It's a range base. There is locality of information. But it's not... I don't want the users to think that, okay, if every entity is a different unique partition key, that's bad. It's not, actually. It's actually very good, given that your entity group transactions and stuff like that, you lose that factor.
Then depend on how you're using that data. So as to whether you're going to cluster stuff into one partition key, or in this case with user registration, you always know the partition key and row key, it's predictable, and generally you're only pulling back those users.
Right. So a lot depends on the query scenario as such. Yeah. When you don't want too many entities back as such, or you don't want to have this atomic transaction across multiple entities, your user entity can just be a single entity where the ID is your user ID, whatever the email ID, yeah, hash of
the
email ID, and
the partition key.
Right? Yes, the partition key. Sorry. Yeah. The row key, I don't have to use it.
Okay.
It can be empty.
All right.
Right? Because it's already unique. A user ID is already unique. What this brings me is, if a different user tries to register with the same one, the system already returns a conflict when you try to insert.
Yep.
If in the row key, if I have the last name and first name, it for example, and now you could go and use the same foo user ID,
right,
and it's going to allow you. So I'll have to check if the partition key is unique anyways. So I might as well leave my row key empty.
So it's it's actually, there's benefits to leaving the row key empty.
Yes, in certain cases.
In certain scenarios,
And so I'll have my partition key and row key designed in this fashion, and everything is a single entity lookup, and this works just great. Whenever the user logs in, you go look up for that username, get the entity back again, check your password or whatever it is, and then allow the user to log in.
Gotcha. So is it? I think now that I think back, I've actually made the mistake where I've used, and actually there's a lot of samples out there that do this where they put the partition key as like default, and then the row key is the user ID. And it sounds like, I mean, there could be a scenario where that maybe is better, but is that ever better?
It is fine if, let's say states.
Okay.
Right? I want all the states in the United States.
Yep.
My row key can be all the state.
I see.
Partition key can be empty. It's a small set. I can cache that data. I'm not going to hit the store as, I'm not going to cross my limits or anything of that sort in scanning. Right? All that is good.
Would that actually, so states, is that's a good example. Would the query of, say, I put state as just, I put the partition key called states, and it's the only data in the table, and I have all the states, is that more efficient and just say, give me all the rows that have states as the partition, is that more efficient than just saying, give me all the rows in this table, even though they're only going to be 50?
So given, if it's not load balanced, because the load balancing is on the partition key level.
Yep.
So if for whatever reason you keep, the traffic on that particular table is a lot, and our system believes that it needs to split it, then having the partition key as a state will load balance it. Now, when you query for all the states, you might have to need a continuation token to get it, right? But if you are anyway doing that many transactions that requires a load balancing on our part, it means that you shouldn't have it as a single partition anyways.
Yeah.
So there are those... For low load, I think it's fine to have partition key as empty.
Okay.
And the benefit might be that you want to update all the states with the temperature or whatever it is.
Okay.
And you can do it in a single entity group transaction.
I see. Okay.
So, which you cannot do if the state was a partition key.
But if the system thought there was load, it could split them up, which means when you say, give me all the rows, you would actually get, say, half of them, and then a continuation token. I see. Okay.
Right.
So if the system, under low traffic, it really doesn't matter, because the system's going to just put them all in the same partition anyway. You're going to give me all the rows. You're not going to notice, but it's actually interesting, because a user, without understanding that, could actually make a mistake that they don't ever see until the app gets under high load. So it is, very important to understand.
Right. It is important to understand that, and we have had a lot of users use this default as a partition key, even in high-scale scenarios, and it doesn't scale, right? Because you get the throughput of a single partition server. And so it is important to recognize that, and that's a very good question.
Cool.
The only scenario where I think it's beneficial is low load, and you want entity group transactions.
I see.
That's the scenario where you might use the same partition key and different.
So, unless you're doing low load and you need group transactions, you probably want to really consider why, you know, should I really be using default as the partition key? Otherwise, you should probably go to. I mean, you can almost say the default recommendation is use
the partition key
and not the
Definitely.
Row key. Okay, cool.
Yeah. And so this is one scenario where I have the partition key. And the reason I'm not keeping this as default is because if my website becomes really, if Justin Bieber, for example, signs on my website, I might now start getting the Justin Bieber bump or Mark Zuckerberg bump on my website. And so that kind of, that is the reason why I'm not using my partition key as default and keeping each user ID in its own partition key.
Gotcha.
And it's, there's nothing wrong or no inefficiency that is caused by doing that. The second example that I would go through is document. And this is where I have some code. There's a document, and associated with document are comments. Right? In a traditional system, you will have your document table, and then you'll have your comment table. Document ID is a foreign key in your comment table, and you, whenever you want all the documents or other comments for a document, you'll do a join and you'll get it. So that would be a kind of way you would have done in a traditional SQL Server or a relational database system. Mm-hmm. It's a NoSQL store, it's schema-less, so you can store both these entities in the same table.
Yep.
And we'll go over the benefits of that. For example, the scenario is every time I upload a document, or rather, every time I set a comment on the document, I want to increase the count.
The comment count?
The comment count on the document. So that when I retrieve all the documents, it also can show how many comments do I have on each document. When I, the main query is retrieve all documents or retrieve top 100 documents or whatever. There's pagination out there. But retrieve some documents. I'm going to remove all because I can have a million documents. So this would be one more query scenario for my website. And when I click on the document, I want to retrieve top end comments. So this could be something which I want to kind of achieve using Azure Table. And to do this, one of the ways is basically I'll have a document entity. And I'll have a comment entity. The document entity partition key is user ID, because all documents belong to a given user.
Okay.
And the reason I've not put document ID out here, which can be in a high-scale scenario as such, is because at any given time, I'll be uploading only a few documents, mm-hmm. videos or whatever it is. It's not like it's programmatic interface where I can start kind of hammering it with a lot of documents.
Yeah.
So this should be fine. And the other thing which I would do is my row key would be the document ID.
Okay.
So every document gets a unique ID. The thing which I can also do out here, and again, like I said, there's no need for me to actually keep the doc ID as row key, but I'm just keeping it out here so that all the users' documents will be together, mm-hmm. right? And then it'll have its own properties like comment count. Sorry, my writing sucks. And for comments, again, I'll have a user ID. The comment is associated with the document, mm-hmm. so I'll keep it as doc ID with a separator, and then comment ID.
So partition key, user ID, and row key.
So this is my PK.
Right.
This is my RK.
Yeah, gotcha.
Cool.
Right?
Yep.
So I can do this now. The good thing about this is whenever I'm inserting a comment, I can use entity group transaction because it has the same partition key.
Yep.
Update the comment count by one and also insert the comment associated with it. Right? So this gives me a good sorting order. Mm-hmm. Or at least that's what I think.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So this is one way to do it. The second way I can do is for the document entity, I'll have user ID. I'll have the row type, which will say it's a document. And then the doc ID with the separator, and then the doc ID. And the rest are same. And for the comment, it would be user ID. Type is comment. And then I'll have the doc ID separator comment ID. So I have two options out here.
Okay.
Right? The second one actually drives me to think which one would be better. Because everything is sorted by partition key, row key. Mm-hmm. If I have a million comments for a given document, it means that I'm going to have a document, and I'll show you some data out there, and then followed immediately by all the comments for this particular document, the million one comments. And then I'll have the next document.
Yep.
Right. Is this confusing? Or
No. And I think you have some code, which yes. actually really, really makes it very
right.
clear as also.
And so when I try to retrieve all my documents, it's not going to scan these million rows.
Mm-hmm. To get to the next one.
To get to the next document.
Yep.
And that's where the kind actually helps me differentiate this and get this efficient sorting in my table.
Yep.
And
so the first one, you're literally going to have to keep page. I mean, finding the documents is basically, I mean, if you have a billion documents, you would
right.
find that to take a long, long time.
It would take a longer time to go through it. Our service is efficient to scan through these, but it is going to take more time for you compared
yeah.
to the second one.
Okay.
And since I wanted to make sure that all these are efficient, it seems like the second one is a better fit.
Okay. So you've got some code. So we sort of talked about, we talked about some of the techniques and some of the high level, and now you've actually got some code to demonstrate some of these
yes.
In action. Cool.
Right. And so I have these the schema out here. This is my first version of it where I use the document ID without the kind in my row key. So I have my partition key as user ID, my row key as the document ID. I've stored the user ID out here, again, just as part of not the partition key, as a separate property,
yep.
but
yep.
I marked it internal so that it's not serialized.
I see.
And so the WCF data service client library would not send any internals over the wire.
Okay.
And so I just have the user ID, which I can use. Rather than using partition key, I
mm-hmm.
can use what actually means something to me in the
that
data model.
Right.
I have this row type out here, which tells me if it is a document or a comment. I've just used 0 for documents and 1 for comments in this sample. Rating, which I'm not using at this point, but there's a comment count where I'm tracking all the comments, and then the short description for the document itself and the name. So this is what I have in my entity, and I've derived it from table service entity out here.
Yep.
Which provides me partition key, row key, and timestamp. You don't have to declare the timestamp, but partition key and row key are necessary.
Are there are attributes you have to put on if you or do you just have to have those properties?
It's the properties that you need.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's no. Actually, if you go to a table service entity, it just is
oh, okay.
partition key
cool.
gets it,
yeah.
row key. And then the comment entity, where my partition key is the user ID again.
Yep.
My row key, as I said, is just the document ID with a delimiter, and then the comment ID. And then out here I have, again, if I need rating or anything of that sort, I don't need anything of this. I'm not going to use that. There's a comment ID, document ID, which I've, again, serialized just because my comment ID is part of the row key. I didn't want to kind of go and split it to get my comment ID, so I'm just going to store the comment ID too. So this is what I have out here. And again, user ID is internal. So this is my first schema.
So one question here for some people who may not have used Windows Azure Storage before. So at the moment, you're using long int and string as your data types there. But what other data types are supported?
So you have date time. You have a byte array that
right.
we support. And so those are kind of, and Boolean, of course. So those are the data types that we support,
yep.
The EDM types that we support.
Right. Did you say you supported byte?
Byte array.
Byte array.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
And so let's go to the data access layer. So when I want to add a comment, this is what I was saying. I have a table service context, which is nothing but data service context from WCF data services. It just derives from it. And the table service context provides operations like save changes with retry. So it has
mm-hmm.
these retries
mm-hmm.
implemented. The second thing that the table service also provides is, or the data service query doesn't support continuation tokens. and we have our own continuation token implementation in the table service query.
Okay.
So those are two classes that we've implemented, but otherwise it's just plain WCF data service underneath. So it's a very light wrapper around data service context. And so in my add comment, I've created a new comment. I've used GUIDS for my comment ID. I've created whatever comment I had to create against that particular document.
Yep.
And I use Roki out here because the Roki was document ID. And then I add this object. I update the document count, the comment count on the document, and then use a batch transaction. This is the atomic transaction. This is what gives me the atomicity to update that comment count on the document and also insert it in one single operation.
Okay.
All right.
And so this is the code that I've used to kind of add comments. And to list documents, I have partition key equal to user ID, and the row type is a document. That's all. And I've used the as table service query out here, which goes and handles continuation tokens for me. I do a list and returns all the list of all the documents that are there. I could use a take out here to kind of limit the number of documents I get. But
so this query could actually, this is not necessarily one table service query because they're using continuation tokens. Just for people that aren't familiar with this, you could potentially be making 10, 50, whatever.
You could get
a million comments. It could last for a long, well, it could last for 5 seconds and then be, no, because continuation.
Continuation, so it could last for a long time if you have like a billion entities out there. And so that's why you, in a normal web app, you would use a take count to ensure that you only get 10 entities or something of that sort, and then have pagination out there on the UI. But just to drive home my point in terms of the scan, the scan on the server, I just want to get all the documents.
Yep.
And so this is kind of a quick way of getting all my documents. I have the second model, which I said, where I can keep the kind in the row key. And in this one, I prepend every entity with its kind, then the delimiter, and then the doc ID. And so I've stored the document ID too. And similar with the comment ID. In the comment ID, I have the comment type as my row key, then the delimiter, then the document ID, and then the delimiter again, and then the comment ID.
Okay.
So I have delimited all of that different fields. And so the thing to note out here is I've concatenated, though I've given you just one single clustered index with two fields, you can concatenate fields to create your own richer index
kind of
thing. And so that's my comment entity v2. To list all the documents, what I've done here is partition key equal to user ID, row key compare with this particular delimiter. So everything greater than documents.
Mm-hmm.
And I've this is the next character after colon.
Oh, okay.
Right? I've used a semicolon. And that kind of, I limit it to that particular range of entities.
I see.
To just get documents. Let's go to the server.
So that for those that aren't that haven't done this before, that's just the sort order, the lexical sort order. You're saying start at colon and then the next lexical sort character is semicolon. Okay,
right.
I think some people see that and they're like, what does the semicolon mean? Yeah. So gotcha.
Yeah, and maybe this table out here. This is my V2 table.
Yep.
And if you look at my row key, I have this as my row key, and all the documents are first listed.
Yep.
I have about 40 documents, if I'm not mistaken. And then for each of those documents, I have the comments listed.
Okay.
And so what you wanted is everything that begins with 0 and ends before 1.
Yep.
You could also use 1, for example.
Okay. And you can see in this one versus the other one, which if you flip over to the V1.
The V1.
So this one is, I mean, you can really see the difference in how this works. You see, you've got a document here.
Yeah.
And then you have three comments.
Yes.
And then another document and a bunch of comments. And you can see really where that could be.
Yes.
I mean, it'd take a while to query.
And so this would be my sort out. And a quick compare out here. I've just executed V2 multiple times.
Okay.
In most cases, it's like 150 milliseconds, except the first time when maybe it had to read. Whereas the second table, which does not have kind in the V1 table.
Yep. Mm. That's quite different.
It's scanning all those additional records to do document, comment, document.
Yes.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay. As opposed to pulling back the that's cool.
That's
a significant difference.
What's the reason why the first one took longer in both scenarios?
So that's a good question. There is a cost that you pay even on the client end for the first query.
It goes
through the reflection and look at your entity types and things
like
that.
I see. Oh, yeah, because this is just total time. So you're talking about, I mean, the entity types are most likely cache and memory and things like that. Gotcha.
So
what's the deal with that 970? What do you guys got going on?
This is where analytics comes into picture.
Just before we jump off on that, one question here. So this sample is running on your local machine connecting to Windows Azure Storage.
Yes.
So the latency there, should we expect less latency, obviously, if this is running in
say, Azure itself?
Web role or worker role?
I certainly hope we shouldn't expect more.
I just wanted to clarify that, though, because so what would we see? We're seeing like 100 plus milliseconds if it was running in a worker role. Or a web role doing this query?
So a lot depends, and that's a very good question. A lot of times folks come back and say, hey, you know what, my requests are taking a lot longer when I'm running in Azure Compute, for example. And the reason, one of the things that you would have to do is turn on analytics, and in analytics logs, you will actually see how much the server is taking versus how much the network time is.
Interesting.
Because what also in majority of the cases, what we've seen is the client app, is running a .NET worker station GC in the foreground mode, and it keeps getting stalled. The memory pressure on the client is what is causing most of this problem. With high CPU and things of that. So generally, the thing that we ask is, okay, why don't you just profile your client application, get a Wireshark trace, and so that would give you a thing about. The Wireshark trace will tell you if you're reading fast enough from the pipe or if basically you didn't read fast enough and it was the service. Yep. In addition, analytics should tell you all that stuff.
That's a good tip. That's our tip of the week. We'll edit that in.
So I have my analytics logs turned on, and this is fifth.
So for those people that haven't seen the Windows Azure Storage Analytics, how would they go about turning?
1.6 API, there was a easy API where you can start kind of creating the set service properties is what we've called it. You can call it on each of your endpoints, blob, tables, and queues, to turn the analytics on. And the good part about analytics is it does not impact your account. The transactions or whatever the system does on behalf of the user for analytics is a different namespace. So it does not encounter. And it, even
from
the
a performance
space,
standpoint,
from a performance
you
standpoint,
do have to pay for the storage,
so you do,
right?
You do and have to pay for the transactions and storage.
Yeah.
But in addition, even the space does not account for that 100 terabyte limit.
Okay, very cool. And also, you can also enable, I think, like you're using Cloud Storage Studio. I think they have tools actually.
Yes, they have tools.
I mean, most Azure developers use some, have their preferred storage.
Right. I have a license for this, so I'm using this. But yeah, you can use your preferred tool, which allows you to turn on analytics and turn on the retention policy so that you don't have those logs lasting for months together. Turn it on for how many ever days you need it for debugging. And so let's go here and just refresh this. I have this log. So you look at these queries out here.
Forget it.
Okay. And this is what tells you that, okay, this is your end-to-end latency versus how much the service took. 697 versus 690 milliseconds.
Right.
So this is what the service took, and this is end-to-end. If there's a major discrepancy between these two, something's wrong with your network.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. That's what I wanted to show in terms of how you need to kind of design your schema and what are the things that you need to take care of while designing your schema. There are multiple ways to do it. There are pros and cons to each one, so take care of that.
Cool. So I think, I mean, one thing, we talked about the way you design your tables, we talked about the storage guidelines. People ask a lot, you say, 5,000 requests per transaction or things like that. I mean, it's important to note that just because we have those limits with either a partition or an account or whatever it may be, like you could build an app that had, say, 100,000 requests per second, right?
Yes.
It's just a matter of, I mean, there's certainly, 100,000 requests per second to storage is a big app, and it's going to be, you have to design it the right way, but it is possible.
Yes, it is possible, and people have built such apps on Azure Table itself. For example, the Bing search for Facebook and Twitter feed as such, the Firehose, they have in excess of 40,000 transactions per second. In addition, I would say, this is not your classic sexy demo in terms of the UI and all that stuff. It's a data model, but hopefully by TechEd I should have a web app running across this. Also wanted to talk about a few things in terms of Azure queues and tables.
Yeah.
We'll be having shared access signatures for tables and queues so that you don't have to have a token on your Windows mobile phone or on your iPhone or whatever it is.
So when you say token, just to clarify for people, you don't have to have your storage account credentials.
Yes.
So you will actually be able to, from your... So right now, we do that in the toolkits. Well, in the toolkits for blobs, we allow you to, say, get a shared token, upload, and then directly from, like, your iPhone or Windows phone or whatever client you're building, upload to blob storage. But now with queues and...
And tables.
Excellent. Right. That means you have to rewrite the entire Windows 8 toolkit. So have fun.
the WinPhone one at the moment.
Oh, you still haven't added...
We haven't added storage support into it.
Well, so you better it on that.
I've got a lot to do.
So that's actually real. I mean, that's really good, though, because
more information to come on TechEd. I think Tuesday is my talk, and I'll be giving more information on how you can use, because it has this granular permissions and stuff like that.
Great. The way we currently do it in the WinPhone toolkit to avoid that account credential being on the device is we just proxy it. Request for tables and queues.
I mean, that's really, it's not ideal because you have... you pay for extra compute, you get extra latency, you're making two HTTP requests, really.
Precisely. Your service has to scale as much as what your mobile apps would have to scale, which
That's
is not
fantastic.
The ideal stuff. So, shared access signatures would be out.
Cool. Yeah. Okay. I like that we got a leak some news. We're all going to get fired for it, but it was worth it. Our ratings are going to go up now.
Yeah.
That's great. That's very good to hear. We'll have to we talked about the mobile toolkit, so we'll have to have Chris... get some updates out with that. So, cool. Well, this is like a huge topic. I mean, people ask about this a lot. There's certainly a lot more than we talked about today. So I think we'd like you to commit on air to coming back at least 10 times. But we definitely really should have you on again, because I think there's a lot more we could go into, especially in... more with scale. I mean, we could talk more about blobs and queues and things like that.
Sure, definitely. Yeah. We need to talk about blobs and queues, especially with respect to scale.
Cool. Yeah. And then there's probably some more, maybe you have some more more secret stuff you're announcing soon.
At TechEd, for sure. Yeah.
Cool.
There will be more coming, other than shared access signatures. Yes.
Cool. So we'll have you on after that to kind of talk about. Great.
Cool.
Great. So, it was a long episode, but I think it was... after Bob edits it out, it'll be 3 or 4 minutes long.
I think I actually got a suntan when I was standing next to the TV on the side.
From the TV, nice.
That was really hot.
But I think it's some really good information. I mean, I know people ask about this a lot. Storage, it can be complicated. There are a lot of... There's SQL, SQL Azure, there's table storage, there's Azure queues, there's service bus queues. So there's a lot of different options, which, of course, choice is great, but it also makes it a little more complicated for a developer. So it's very important to understand the pros and cons of each one.
Right. Yeah, I actually have a question from a viewer for you.
Okay.
So it's related to table storage. So essentially he was looking at table storage for the first time, and he was using MongoDB or something like that prior to store entities with a very large object graph. And that object graph come up like to about 4 megs. So what's the limitation in terms of a particular row in table storage, and what advice would you give someone like that?
In terms of entity size, we have a 1 MB limit on the entity itself. With respect to how large can an entity get, it depends on your scenario, because if you want to scan these entities now, and if your entity sizes are large, it just means that there are more IOs on the back end required to kind of read your entity set, the entire entity set. And so... One of the things that folks have done is actually any large entity and which doesn't require kind of query capacity, they would store it in a blob and then just have metadata in table, which they would index over the properties that they need. Yeah. And so that's one of the ways to kind of design your application for scale and for better I/O.
All right. Cool. Awesome. Thanks.
Yeah. Great. Well, with that, I think it's about that time. So with that, I guess let's go to the tip of the week.
Tip of the week.
Boy! So until next time, catch one for me and enjoy the great fishing America has to offer. We'll see you next time.
Whoa, Nelly!
I thought I had it in reverse.
And we're back. All right, that was
horrible.
Nick's really, really been. Your enthusiasm is really lacking. No,
yeah.
Just
late nights.
Yeah. So we talked a lot about table storage. So we're gonna do a tip of the week about Service Bus. Mm. So I've just been playing around with SignalR recently, just for, I don't know, so I don't have enough real work to do. I've just been playing around with it. So SignalR, for those not familiar, is sort of a real-time, I don't know what it's a layer. It's a NuGet package that allows you to do real-time web apps. So it uses, real long polling, a variety of different techniques to do real-time web applications with ASP.NET. Similar to a lot of people have used Socket.io and Node.js. Similar to that, but one issue that comes up a lot is, it uses in-memory store, right? So what if I deploy three different web roles, three different cloud apps, three instances? How do I do the real-time communication? Because with the load balancer, user A might hit instance zero, user B might hit instance three, and if I'm actually want to push data or have them communicate, things like that, build the classic chat room example, how do I actually communicate in real time between those instances so my users get real time? And so the Service Bus team actually built a NuGet package that layers on top of SignalR that actually allows you to use Service Bus as the backing store for SignalR and then do that real-time communication so you can scale out your SignalR instances. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but what I have here is a web app that already has SignalR, and just adding that that NuGet package is quite easy.
Don't you use a command line, man?
I
thought you were a power user.
Well, I do, but this is a better... No one wants to look at the command. This is prettier, so okay. So we see we've got this SignalR.Windows Azure Service Bus NuGet package, and then this actually adds all the dependencies, the Service Bus, Windows Azure Service Bus package, et cetera, except that license, and adds our dependencies, as NuGet's awesomeness does. So after we install the NuGet package, all we need to do is add this one line of code here, which adds, I'm not actually going to, no, I copied it from the web, so... it's all messed up, whatever. So basically, we just need to set our. I don't know what's going on here. We're just gonna pretend there are no red underlines here. I think I'm actually using a web forms app, and this is whatever. But this one line of code that you need to just set the Service Bus namespace, the account, the key. And then the queue name, I believe, that you're using. So really simple to add Service Bus as a backing store, and then your SignalR application will work as it did before, and you can scale out to n number of instances and build a real-time chat application or something, or we've done stuff with social gaming like that,
okay.
And you can actually scale it out. So cool. I think that's about all for this week. It was a really good episode. We really appreciate you coming and giving that demo. And we'll definitely have to have you back again to go even more in depth.
And Jay, would it be okay if we perhaps get a zip of that sample so we can share it with
sure,
our users
definitely.
So they can run that?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. So with that, I think that's our show. As always, follow us on at Cloud Cover Show. Do you have a Twitter handler?
I barely tweet.
Okay.
So.
You're like this. So you actually have one at least.
Yes.
I can't remember who. Oh, it was Krishna with the security team.
Right.
He didn't even have Twitter, but his excuse was that he worked on security, so he really can't
talk about it.
Like today I was fixing I found a new exploit. Here it is. No. So Yeah, follow us on Cloud Cover, and again, send Nick emails with complaints.
That's right.
And with that, we will call it a show. So thanks a lot.
Yep, and thanks for coming, Jay.
Thank you.